He was all done in from the chase. I think he was just happy to be rid of us. Unfortunately, it's a prepaid phone. No ID, no phone numbers on it. There's nothing to trace. He wanted something else besides the coin pieces. He wanted a service from you, and I don't think he wants cupcakes. The Derby Lighthouse isn't the traditional narrow cylindrical lighthouse you see in all the calendars. It's squat and square and made of whitewashed brick. It's 23 feet tall and looks like it was built out of Legos by a 6-year-old kid with no imagination. We reached the end of the narrow spit of land, and the red beacon on the top of the lighthouse began to flash every 6 seconds. The door at the base of the lighthouse was unlocked, so we pushed it open and stepped into a small, dark room. Diesel flipped the light switch, and we saw that the room was empty, with the exception of a metal spiral staircase that led to the rooftop lantern room. The guy from the aquarium was standing at the top of the staircase. A burlap sack was at his feet, a nasty-looking semi-automatic was in his hand, and he had a booted foot on the sack, holding it in place while something squirmed inside. Diesel stood, hands on hips, looking up at the guy.
I'm guessing my monkey's in that sack.
You guess right, the guy said. And if I get alarmed, I might kick him over the side, so don't try anything stupid. There's more of the coin hidden here somewhere. As soon as I heard the poem the old man was blathering on about, I had a hunch. A light to guide her by. That's his lighthouse, right? I was thinking about the lighthouse even before I heard the poem because Pegleg spent a lot of time here. When he was working as a cod fisherman, he would sometimes tend the light during winter months. I was going to try a metal detector, but you're even better. You're the special person who's got the power.
How do you know about that? Someone's a big blabbermouth.
Yeah, word gets around.
Does your hunch tell you where I should start looking?
There's nothing in here but walls and floor. Start with the walls and do it fast. I haven't got all day.
I ran my hands over the brick walls. I was on the third wall when I felt a vibration. It's here, I said, the third brick from the bottom.
Dig it out, the guy said.
I looked up at him. Do you have a power drill on you? Jackhammer? Nail file? He tossed a medium-sized screwdriver over the railing.
The jackhammer wouldn't fit in my pocket. Get to work.
Diesel retrieved the screwdriver and chipped away at the mortar around the brick. After 5 minutes, he was able to pop the brick out. The back was partially missing, and the inside was hollowed out and stuffed with wadded-up cloth. Diesel pulled the cloth out, tipped the brick over, and 2 bits of the coin fell out into his hand.
Bring the pieces to me, the guy said. Send them up with Miss Magic.
Diesel handed the 2 pieces over, and I climbed the circular stairs, stopping when I was within arm's reach of Carl and his captor. I dropped the 2 pieces into the monkey napper's hand and reached for the burlap sack.
Not so fast, the guy said. I know you have more pieces.
I have one more, Diesel said. Catch.
Diesel tossed the piece up to the guy, and when he lunged for the piece of coin, I reached for Carl. The guy snagged the coin, and I slipped the knot on the sack. Carl wriggled free and launched himself at the man's face. Carl was screeching, and the man was screaming and batting at Carl, ineffectively flailing his arms with the gun still in his hand. The gun discharged, and time stood still for a beat, when we all realized he'd shot himself. Diesel whistled, and Carl disengaged, leaping from the top of the stairs onto Diesel's shoulder.
Oh, crap,
the guy said, looking down at his stomach, where a bloodstain was beginning to show. His eyes rolled back, and he crumpled, falling head first over the metal railing. There was a loud crack and a thud, and then total silence. We rushed over to see if we could help, but he was beyond anything we could do. He was beyond anything anyone could do. He still had the gun in his hand. His head was mashed into his neck, and blood was pooling under him. Nurgle answered his phone on the 5th ring.
So, how's it going? I said to him.
Pretty good. How's it going with you?
Diesel had laid the burlap monkey sack over the guy's face and what was left of his neck, and I was trying not to look in that direction.
It's going okay, I said. So, what are you doing tonight?
Not much. Watching television.
Do you think you would be able to come out?
Are you having one of those special people mixers?
Sort of.
Great. Where is it?
The Derby Lighthouse.
That's a terrific place for a party, he said. I'm not far away. I'll be right there.
This is totally horrible, I said to Diesel. How are we going to explain this?
It's either accidental suicide or death by monkey. I'm going to push for suicide.
10 minutes later, there was a knock on the door, and Diesel went to answer it. Nurgle stepped in and handed Diesel a bottle of wine.
Am I late? He asked. Where is everyone?
It's just getting started, I said.
Yeah, Diesel said. By midnight, this place will be rocking.
Nurgle looked over at Carl, and Carl flipped him the bird.
Does a monkey have enhanced abilities too? Nurgle asked. Is he a powerful wizard under an enchantment?
This isn't Hogwarts, Diesel said, unscrewing the cap on the wine and chugging some from the bottle. Nurgle caught sight of the body on the floor and the blood leaking out from under the burlap.
Uh-oh, Nurgle said. We have sort of a situation here, Diesel said, lifting the burlap sack
so Nurgle could appreciate the fact that the head was basically sitting on the man's shoulders.
Whoa, Nurgle said. This isn't really a party, is it? No, but we're a pretty fun group. I can see that, Nurgle said, approaching the body.
We didn't kill him, I said. We just found him like this, more or less.
Did you call the police?
Not yet.
Most people think of that first thing when they find a body.
Do you think you could touch him? I asked, gesturing vaguely with my hands. Do your thing?
He hesitated.
This is very irregular. I usually do it with the police around, as a CSI.
Think of it as a secret mission, I said, for EAF.
What's that?
The Enhanced Abilities Force.
Is that a real thing?
It could be, I said.
Nurgle went down to one knee and put his hand on the body.
This guy died pretty pissed off.
He had a bad day, I said.
Nurgle tilted his head as if he were listening.
I'm getting a lot of complaints about a monkey. Way to go, Carl, Diesel said. And he's thinking he made a bad decision to go off on his own, Nurgle said.
On his own where? I asked. What does that mean?
That's what I'm getting, Nurgle said. And he wished he hadn't shot himself.
After we were done communing with the dead, we made an anonymous call to the police and left. Nurgle wanted to go out for a drink, but I asked for a rain check. I gave him a sterile kiss on the cheek and thanked him for the wine. Diesel drove me back to the bakery so I could get my car, then he and Carl followed me home.
There's something I should tell you, Diesel said when we were at my front door. It could be a mess in there.
I looked at him with raised eyebrows.
I left Carl in your house today, so that's where he was snatched. Probably there was a tussle.
A tussle?
Unless the monkey napper had a bag of donuts, Carl wouldn't voluntarily go into that sack.
I opened the door and gasped. The house was a wreck, and Cat was standing his ground with his fur bushed out like a porcupine's quills. He saw Diesel and me, and he relaxed. The couch cushions were on the floor, and furniture was overturned. In the kitchen, canisters were emptied onto the counter with flour and sugar sifted out everywhere. Boxes had been torn open and emptied. Trash was spread across the floor.
This was more than a struggle to get Carl, Diesel said. This was a search for the coin pieces.
Diesel was still carrying the bottle of wine. I took it from him and chugged some.
Let's clean this up, I said. By morning, this will be an ant factory.
2 hours later, we had the kitchen scrubbed clean, and the wine bottle was empty.
Hey, handsome, I said to Diesel. Let's go to bed.
Diesel grinned over at me. You drank almost that whole bottle of wine.
I did, and it was yummy.
You might be a little snuckered.
Not me, I said. I can hold my liquor.
I sidled up to him, nuzzled his neck, and kissed him just below his ear.
You smell delicious, I said. I could eat you up, all over, if you know what I mean.
The grin widened.
My lucky day.
I slipped my hand under his t-shirt and ran my fingers over his perfectly defined abs.
I said, dipping my hand inside his jeans.
I heard him give a sharp intake of air, and I continued to explore uncharted territory. "Am I doing okay?" I asked. "What I lack in experience, I make up for in enthusiasm."
Had me fooled. It feels to me like you know what you're doing.
I like these soft, round things.
Yeah, I can tell. Listen, maybe we should go a little slower.
I wrapped my hand around his joystick. Going to warp speed, Captain. Brace yourself. We're in launch mode.
Eep,
Carl said. Oh, crap, I said. The monkey is watching.
Ignore the monkey.
I can't ignore the monkey. I feel like a porn star.
Is that good or bad?
It's bad. Carl was sitting back on his haunches 3 feet away, his eyes wide, taking it all in. Maybe we should do this some other time, I said to Diesel.
Honey, you've got me in launch mode.
Yeah, but you can abort the mission, right? Diesel grabbed Carl and locked him in the broom closet. He returned to me, pulled me close, and kissed me. His hand was under my shirt. His thumb traced a path across my nipple, and his tongue touched mine. Bang, bang, bang. Carl didn't want to be locked in the broom closet. I can't concentrate with all that banging, I said to Diesel.
Do you need to concentrate?
Yes. Diesel let Carl out of the broom closet, took my hand, and tugged me up the stairs to my bedroom. He closed and locked my bedroom door, leaving Carl on the outside. Are you sure this is going to be okay? I asked him. I don't want to have to save the world all by myself.
We'll only do certain things.
Does that include launching?
Yeah, we're both gonna launch.
Okay, but I hope you know what you're doing.
I've never had any complaints.
Chapter 9. My alarm went off as usual at 4:15. Diesel reached over me, grabbed the clock, and threw it across the dark room. If it's broken, you're going to have to buy me a new one, I said.
If it isn't broken, I'm going to smash it with a hammer until it's dead.
I felt around under the covers. We were both naked.
Uh-oh, I said. If you keep feeling around like that, you're going to be late for work,
Diesel said. Are we damaged?
I don't feel damaged.
I rolled out of bed and touched one of the pieces of coin that were on the nightstand. It vibrated under my touch. I'm okay, I said.
Honey, you're way better than just okay.
That was good to know, and it had me smiling. Still, I thought I should try to stay sober and not take a chance a second time. Not to mention, it would be a disaster of major proportions if I should fall in love with him. And this morning, I was thinking it would be easy to fall in love. 20 minutes later, I was showered and dressed and only slightly hungover. The bed was empty when I came out of the bathroom. No Diesel, no Cat, no Carl. Everyone was in the kitchen waiting for breakfast. I got the coffee brewing, filled the toaster with frozen waffles, scrambled up a bunch of eggs, and opened a can of cat food. I'm off to work, I said to Diesel. What's your plan for the day?
I have the name of the monkey napper. It made the local news this morning. They said he died from a self-inflicted gunshot wound and a broken neck. I'd like to get some background information on him.
It had been a slow day at the bakery. This was bad for Clara, but good for me. I brought home a big bag of leftover meat pies, muffins, and cheese scones. My house felt benign when I rolled in. No overturned furniture, no bad guys lurking in closets, no monkey. I love Carl, but he creates chaos. I said hello to Cat and gave him part of a sausage turnover. The rest of the food went into the fridge. I closed the refrigerator door, turned around, and bumped into Martin Ammon. Holy bejesus, I said, jumping away from him. How did you get into my house?
You didn't lock your door. Not smart in this day and age. Anyone can walk in.
No kidding.
I had a free moment this afternoon, so I thought I'd drop off your contract.
In person? He looked around.
I was curious to see how you lived. This is small, isn't it? And your kitchen is quite antiquated. Do you actually cook here?
Occasionally. He pulled a multi-page contract out of a slim briefcase and placed it on the counter with a pen.
You need to initial each page and sign on the back page.
I should read this first.
If you must, he said. It's standard, nothing unusual. I give you money and you give me a cookbook, and also cupcakes. Cupcakes on demand. I trust you won't mind that. I'm not here year-round.
I started to read the first page and my eyes glazed over. Is this written in English?
It's lawyer talk. Perhaps you'll want to engage a lawyer to translate it for you, or you could sign with an agent. Most agents take 15%.
I looked at my decrepit stove and chipped Formica countertop. I didn't want to give up 15%. I needed all the money Ammon was paying me.
I'm having a fundraiser at my house on Saturday, Ammon said. Something to do with the environment, I believe. You're invited. In fact, I would like you to make the desserts. We'll have media there, and it will make a good launch opportunity for the Lizzie Tucker brand.
He checked his watch.
I have to run. Rutherford is circling the block. There's no place to park in this neighborhood. The city should bulldoze some of these dilapidated houses and put in some parking.
This is the historic section of town. These houses are hundreds of years old.
Obviously.
He tapped his finger on the contract.
Have you finished reading yet?
I scanned the document and saw that the ultimate payment was circled in red. $500,000. I signed. Ammon left and Clara called 10 minutes later.
I've been thinking about the poem, Clara said. I wrote out the version Gramps always repeated, and I looked up the original version. There are several differences. Not sure if the differences are significant, but Glow's going to bring both versions to you when we close the shop.
I thanked Clara and disconnected. What do you think? I asked Kat. Are the clues to the treasure hunt found in Gramps' poem? Kat looked uncertain. Here's a bigger question, I said to Kat. Is any of this going to lead us to a Seligia stone? Kat stared at me. Exactly, I said. There's no guarantee, right? We could be on a big wild goose chase. I shared some apple slices with Kat and began a list of repairs I would be able to make on the house. A new roof was a top priority. I love my house, I said to Kat, but I can't really afford it. Even without a mortgage payment, the taxes and maintenance bills are killing me. Kat's ear pricked forward, and he gave a low growl. The back door opened, and Carl bounded in, followed by Diesel. Kat looked them over, decided they were no threat, and hunkered down with his half tail tucked in. How'd it go with the monkey napper sleuthing? I asked.
The guy's name was Bernie Wiener, and he happens to be the detective that Ammon hired to find the coin. After some digging, I located his ex-wife. I thought we could go talk to her.
Now?
Yeah, it won't take long. She lives in Lynn.
Lynn is a little southwest of Marblehead and has a lot of hardworking people in it, plus some people who don't work at all. Wiener's ex lived in a small house in a modest neighborhood. There was a big wheels trike in the minuscule front yard. The woman who answered the door looked exhausted. She had a baby balanced on her hip and a toddler wrapped around her leg.
What? She said.
Diesel introduced himself as an insurance investigator and told her he was doing some background work on Bernie.
I haven't got a lot of time, she said. The baby is teething and the toddler has the poops. Bernie was an idiot. I don't know what else to tell you. I wasn't that surprised to hear he was, you know, he could get talked into anything. He should never have taken that job for Martin Ammon. It became an obsession. He thought he was Indiana Jones off looking for some holy relic. If he spent as much time with me as he did looking for that stupid coin, we'd still be married. Thanks, Diesel said. This has been helpful. I don't suppose there's any money in this for me, she asked. Did he have a policy? Was I listed? I don't have that information, Diesel said. I hope it works out for you.
We returned to the car, and Diesel drove back to Marblehead. That was depressing, I said. I feel bad for her.
It looks like she's struggling with the money, but she has two healthy kids, aside from the poops, and I bet she's a good mom, Diesel said. She'll be okay. According to Nurgle, Bernie's last thought was that he regretted going off on his own, so it sounds to me like he might not have been working for Ammon at the end.
I had the same thought.
Diesel parked in front of my house, and we migrated to the kitchen. I gave Cad and Carl a snack, and I watched Diesel place his 5 coin pieces on the counter and fit them together. Even though pieces were still missing, it was clear that an image of a crown was engraved on one side of the coin. Diesel turned the pieces over, and I could see a face engraved on the other side. Charles III of Spain. Each of the pieces had a tiny hole punched into it. Someone rapped on my back door, and Diesel opened it to Glow and Josh.
Howdy, Josh said. How's it going?
Slow, Diesel said. Glow gave me the 2 versions of sea fever.
Clara said she picked out 3 discrepancies. She has them circled. She asked her gramps about the changes, and he said that's just the way the poem was always said to him.
Star had been changed to light. Steer had been changed to guide. To the vagrant gypsy life had been changed to the dazzling gypsy life. Do you think these changes are relevant? I asked Diesel.
The first 2 changes got my monkey back.
We all looked over at Carl, and Carl gave us a hideous, teeth-baring monkey smile.
These coin pieces have holes in them, Glow said. Is that normal?
I shrugged. I didn't know. Diesel didn't know. Josh didn't know.
We could check in with the professor, Josh said. He might still be at work.
Chapter 10. Diesel parked in front of the Sullivan building. We climbed the stairs to Devereaux's floor, and I knocked on his closed door. No answer. Josh opened the door, and we peeked inside. No one there.
Do you have Devereaux's number? Diesel asked Josh. Sure, we're practically friends now. He's called a couple of times asking about the coin.
Josh punched in the number. Devereaux picked up, and Josh put him on speakerphone.
We're in your office, Josh said. Where are you? I had to leave. Why did you come to see me?
We had a question about the pieces of the coin.
Are you still in my office?
Yes.
You need to leave. It's dangerous for you to stay. Run. Get out. I can't talk now. I'll call back.
We exchanged a look, and we didn't exactly run, but we didn't waste any time leaving. We hurried out of the building and stood in the middle of the grassy quad looking up at Devereaux's office window.
Maybe we've been punked, Josh said.
Boom!
Flames shot out of the open window, and the fire alarm went off.
I was wrong, Josh said. That's not the work of a punker.
The alarm was blaring. People were pouring out of the buildings. Sirens screamed in the distance, and Josh's phone buzzed.
I can't hear you, Josh yelled into the phone. Can you repeat that?
We all stared at Josh.
It was Devereaux, Josh said, sliding his phone back into his pocket. I couldn't get everything, but he wanted us to meet him at the museum ship, the Friendship of Salem.
We made our way around the clumps of gawkers and first responders, loaded ourselves into Diesel's orange charger, and Diesel drove us off campus.
I don't want to take everyone on board the Friendship, Diesel said to Glow and Josh. I'm going to drop both of you off first.
The Friendship of Salem was the name of the replica frigate docked at Derby Wharf and used as a museum. We drove to the wharf, left the car on the lot, and walked toward the frigate. It was early evening, and the sun was low on the horizon. The tall masts and rigging were dark against the sky. The squat Derby lighthouse flashed red at the end of the wharf. The gate at the end of the gangway was unlocked. Diesel opened it, and we stepped onto the empty deck of the Friendship. Ropes creaked with the movement of the ship, but all else was silent. We prowled from one end to the other, found an open hatchway, and went below. Diesel flipped a light switch, and we were transported from the 18th century to the 21st century. We were in a shining white room filled with state-of-the-art navigation equipment and a complicated-looking control panel. Professor Devereaux was at the console.
What's up? Diesel said. Are you alone? Devereaux asked. Did anyone follow you? Yes, we're alone, and no, we weren't followed, Diesel said. And, by the way, someone blew up your office. Bastard, Devereaux said. Was anyone hurt? Did the building burn down? Not sure if anyone was hurt, Diesel said. It looked pretty well contained to your office. It's Martin Ammon, Devereaux said. He hates me. He sent one of his goons to tell me to stop looking for the treasure. I told him I wasn't looking for it, that I was merely a historian. And he said historians are the worst treasure hunters of all. And then he said he was going to make sure I understood the consequences of my actions. I assumed he was going to break my arm or slash my face, and I was about to call for security when one of my colleagues came in and Ammon's thug left. When you called, I was worried you would get caught in the crossfire. It didn't occur to me that he would blow up my office.
Why did you come here?
I was in the middle of some research, and I didn't feel safe in my office or my apartment. I knew I could use the equipment here and be undisturbed. As you know, I have a history with the ship. I'm no longer officially involved, but I still return on the sly from time to time.
Why does Ammon hate you? Diesel asked.
Ammon inherited a diary that belonged to Palgrave Bellows. The diary spoke of a fabulous treasure that had been plundered from the Moogle ship Gunsway. Problem was, Ammon didn't know how to find the treasure. It wasn't enough to just have the diary. The treasure was hidden and could only be found with the help of a map and a coin. I'd received some publicity while I was working on the Friendship Restoration, and Ammon approached me offering to share the treasure if I could locate the map and the coin. It was the opportunity of a lifetime. I would have funding to research the lost Gunsway. After almost a year of searching, I ran across the map in a curio shop in Boston. I gave the map to Ammon and continued to search for the coin, but had no luck. It was a total dead end. I was disillusioned by then anyway. In the beginning of our professional relationship, I thought Ammon was a wealthy eccentric. As I got to know him better, I came to realize he's criminally insane. He has delusions of grandeur, and he'll stop at nothing to get what he wants. The diary listed, among other riches, the Avaritia Stone as part of the Moogle treasure. This was Ammon's true reason for funding my research. Ammon had become obsessed with the idea that he might possess the Avaritia Stone. He'd begun to believe that he could awaken the sleeping mammon within himself if he had the stone. He hates me because I know this about him, and because I don't worship mammon.
Did you ever see the diary?
Yes, I had an opportunity to read it, and I think Palgrave Bellows had his own streak of insanity running through him. I'm now told Ammon keeps the diary under lock and key like it's a sacred book.
I believe I've seen the map hanging in Ammon's office.
It's a lovely piece of history, Devereaux said, but worthless as a treasure map without the coin. Directions to the treasure are written in code, and the coin is the key to the code.
And when we came to your office with a piece of a counterfeit coin, you thought it might have been fashioned by Bellows.
Exactly, Devereaux said. I didn't know for certain, but I hoped I was finally seeing part of the coin. And because you are the one who found the fragment, I had hopes that you could find the rest. You have special abilities.
How do you know about my special abilities? I asked him.
It's not exactly a secret, Devereaux said. People talk.
Yeah, I said. I keep hearing this. In most places in this country, people would roll their eyes and smile, and any rumor of my abilities would be filed away next to extraterrestrials landing in Arizona. This was Salem, however, and people were willing to believe just about anything.
Unfortunately, Martin Ammon, with all his fortune and influence, has eyes and ears everywhere, Devereaux said. When it was whispered that pieces of the coin had surfaced, it fueled his obsession to find the treasure.
And he wants you out of the game, I said. Devereaux nodded.
Yes.
Devereaux left to check on his office, and Diesel and I were alone on the ship. I could hear voices in the distance, quiet conversations carrying across the water to us from harborside restaurants. I looked out to sea and thought it would be nice to sail away and leave my strange, confusing life behind. Diesel slipped his arms around me and drew me in close against him.
You wouldn't like it, he said, reading my mind. You'd get seasick, and you'd miss your purpose.
Don't you ever want to abandon all responsibility?
Yeah, all day, every day.
What keeps you in the game?
You don't wear responsibility like clothes. You can't take it off and put it on when you feel like. You wear responsibility on the inside. and it isn't that easy to remove. You have to learn how to live with it.
Wow.
Profound, right? How valuable is that nugget of wisdom? Will it get you undressed?
No.
In that case, it's all bullshit. I stay in the game because at some level I enjoy it. I just don't enjoy it at all levels.
I suspected both explanations were true for Diesel, and neither of them was true for me. Chapter 11. Glow bustled into the bakery exactly at 9 o'clock. She had a newspaper in her tote bag and broom stuck under her arm.
Did you see the paper? She asked Clara and me. The explosion made the front page, and it was on the news this morning on television.
Clara stopped working and looked at Glow.
You read the paper and listen to the news?
No. I ran into Mr. Bork on the street, and he told me about the explosion story, so I bought a paper.
She pulled the paper out of her bag and laid it on a workbench.
There are pictures and everything. They said it was some kind of homemade bomb that had been set on a timer. Nobody was hurt, but there was a lot of damage.
Clara and I went to the workbench and looked at the pictures. I was relieved to find I wasn't in any of them.
You should have been there, Glow said to Clara. We were in Devereaux's office and Josh called him and Devereaux told us to get out of the building, so we ran out and boom, Devereaux's office exploded. And then Josh got a phone call from Devereaux, except he couldn't hear what he was saying.
Scary, Clara said. It would have been terrible if you hadn't gotten out of the office in time.
Who do you think would bomb an office? Glow asked.
The same person who just bought my cookbook, I thought. My phone chirped, and I checked my text messages.
What's wrong? Clara asked. You look like someone just died.
It's a text from Martin Ammon reminding me that I'm supposed to cater a party at his house on Saturday. I'd completely forgotten about it.
Do you need help with the party?
Yes. An hour later, I took off for the Wednesday Farmers Market on Pleasant Street. We use local produce whenever we can, and this morning I bought apples for turnovers, herbs and onions for the meat pies, and I got a bargain on raspberries. I arranged for delivery, and on my way back to the bakery, a hand grasped my shoulder from behind, and I felt a sharp, stabbing pain in my butt cheek. I whirled around and saw Hatchet with a needle in his hand.
Surprise, he said.
When I regained consciousness, I was stretched out on a deck chair on a large yacht. The Salem waterfront was visible in the distance. Hatchet was at the rail. Wolf was seated at a small table nearby, laid out with fresh fruit, croissants, and coffee.
I trust you're well, Wolf said. Hatchet is an expert on paralytic poisons. You should have no ill effects from your nap. I'm having a late breakfast. Would you like to join me?
Just coffee. And I'd like to know the reason for the drugging and kidnapping. Wolf snapped his fingers and Hatchet rushed over, poured a cup of coffee, and handed it to me.
Cream or sugar?
Hatchet asked. I shook my head no.
I asked Stephen to escort you to my boat, Wolf said. The method was his choice.
He gave me a needle in the butt.
Thee were moving, Hatchet said. Hatchet needed a large target.
I narrowed my eyes at him. How'd you like me to punch you in the face?
Thou art an impertinent shrew, Hatchet said.
Wolf cut his eyes to Hatchet, and Hatchet shrank back into the shadows of the salon entrance.
I'm sorry if this caused you discomfort, Wolf said to me. I wanted to speak to you about Martin Ammon. You signed a dangerous contract with him.
How do you know about the contract?
I know many things. For instance, I know that there are those who think Martin Ammon is Mammon. Martin is one of them.
Do you mean Mammon-like, or the actual Mammon?
The actual Mammon.
I realize when you add his first initial to his name, it spells Mammon, but I can't see him as a Prince of Hell. I don't think a Prince of Hell would get a spray tan.
I've seen the contract you signed. Martin Ammon effectively owns you.
My soul?
No, your livelihood, in perpetuity.
Why are you telling me this?
I want you to understand your position and the degree of evil you're facing. Martin Ammon must not get his hands on the Stone of Avarice. He's not interested in your cookbook. He's using the book as a ploy to stay close and to control you with your own greed. He needs you to gather together the 8 pieces of the coin. If he gets the whole coin, he can use it to read Palgrave Bellows's map. Once he reads the map, it's only a matter of time before he possesses the stone.
If you're so concerned, why don't you snatch the map? You could sneak in like smoke, grab the map, and disappear in a flash of light.
I appreciate the vote of confidence, but it's not that simple. There are other forces at play in that house, and my annoying cousin is more suited for larceny.
Are you suggesting that Diesel should steal the map?
I'm suggesting that at all costs you should not help Martin Ammon.
Wolf snapped his fingers again, and Hatchet scurried over to us.
Miss Tucker would like to depart.
Hatchet whipped out a syringe. If he takes a step in my direction, I'm going to jump over the side and swim, I said.
He loves his toys, Wolf said.
He's a nut job.
We won't be needing pharmacology, Wolf said to Hatchet. Drop Miss Tucker off at the wharf.
I followed Hatchet into the launch and looked back at the yacht when the launch pulled away. Wolf wasn't in sight. The name on the boat was Sea Wolf. I put as much distance as I could between Hatchet and me. When we pulled up to the wharf, I carefully moved past him. Is that a dolphin next to the boat? I asked. Hatchet turned to look for the dolphin, and I hit him hard with my tote bag and knocked him overboard into the water. I scrambled out of the launch and walked off without a second glance at Hatchet. Diesel and Carl were at the bakery when I returned.
The produce arrived a half hour ago, Glow said. We were starting to worry about you.
I ran into Wolf.
And? Diesel asked.
And we had an interesting conversation. He said the contract I signed with Martin Ammon was not in my best interest. And then he said there were some who thought M. Ammon was actually Mammon, and that Martin was one of them. We sort of already knew all of that.
Mammon is a demon, Glow said. I read all about him in Ripple's Book of Spells. It has a chapter on devils and demons. Mammon is a demon of greed.
Diesel was slouched against one of the workbenches.
Wolf said he thought Martin Ammon was Mammon?
Not exactly. He said there are those who think he's Mammon. And he said there were other forces at play in Ammon's house.
That's a pretty cryptic message, Diesel said. Did Wolf say anything else?
He said Ammon wasn't interested in my cookbook. He said it was a ploy to get close to me and use my greed to find the 8 pieces of the coin. Once Ammon gets the entire coin, he can use it to read Palgrave Bellows's treasure map, and the map will lead him to the Stone of Avarice. We knew this, too.
It's kind of cool that you know a demon, Glow said to me. Has he ever exhibited any demon behavior? Do his eyes glow? Does he have horn nubs?
None of the above. He's a strange, unpleasant man with perfect teeth.
And billions of dollars, Clara said.
We all went silent for a moment.
Mammon, the demon of greed, Glow said. Think about it.
I personally know an elf and a tree fairy, Diesel said, but I'm having a hard time with the demon of greed.
Wolf sort of suggested that you might want to steal the map, I said to Diesel. He said you're better at larceny than he is.
You could steal it on Saturday, Glow said. We'll all go to the party disguised as dessert caterers.
We are dessert caterers, I said.
That's why it's a perfect cover, Glow said. Diesel can walk off with the map while everyone is snarfing down desserts.
Do you have a license to steal? I asked Diesel.
It's more in the vicinity of vague permission.
Aside from being fun, do you think there's a reason for Diesel to steal the map? Glow said. It isn't as if it's any use to us. We only have 5 pieces of the coin. Wolf has 1 more, and nobody has any idea where to find the other 2.
Okay, let's think about the last 2 pieces, I said. The pieces were hidden by Peg Leg Dazzle. Where would he hide them? He would have kept the last 2 pieces close, just like he did the other 6. 2 were on him, 2 were with Gramps, 2 were in the lighthouse. Clara thunked the heel of her hand against her forehead.
The Dazzle Speakeasy. It's been abandoned since Prohibition ended. Peg Leg practically lived there, at least until he disappeared. It was his pride and joy. You can get there through the underground.
What's the underground? I asked.
It's a series of tunnels built by smugglers. They run underneath the whole city. The rum runners use them, but they date from way before that. Salem has a long history of civil disobedience. Most of the tunnels go back to the first Jefferson administration, when he imposed customs duties on molasses. One of the tunnels runs right under Dazzle's. You can get there through that door right there in the back.
We all moved to the back of the kitchen. Diesel opened the door and stared down into the dark stairwell.
What's down there? Diesel asked Clara.
Not much, Clara said.
Mostly mechanical stuff. Technically, it's a storeroom, but it's not very convenient. It connects to the underground, so I keep the door locked.
Diesel made his way down the rickety stairs and yanked the chain that turned the single overhead bulb on. We all followed Diesel and watched while Clara pushed an empty shelf unit aside on the far wall.
It's a hidden entrance, Clara said.
It's a black yawning corridor of doom, Glow said.
Clara grabbed a flashlight off the shelf and switched it on, splashing light around a cavernous hallway. It was lined in ochre-colored bricks with iron arches every few yards. Carl dashed in front of us. He smiled and gave us the finger when the light hit him.
Diesel took the flashlight from Clara and walked into the tunnel. Do you know where this leads?
Yes, I haven't been down here in years, but I used to play in the tunnels when I was a little girl. I was able to go from my parents' house to the bakery without going above ground. The tunnel also goes to Gramps' house and to the speakeasy.
Diesel moved further into the corridor.
Is the speakeasy still in use?
Only by Gramps. There's a direct access from his broom closet. He calls it his rumpus room. Gramps' house was originally owned by Pegleg, and for a short time, Pegleg ran the speakeasy.
Glow returned to the bakery, and Clara, Diesel, and I followed the tunnel until we came to an iron door.
This is it, Clara said. We can't get in because it's locked from the other side.
No problem,
Diesel said, placing his hand on the door handle.
The lock clicked, and Diesel pushed the door open.
How do you do that? Clara asked.
I'm told it has something to do with my magnetic field, Diesel said.
It wasn't a large room in terms of a public space. It was about the size of the store part of the bakery. Clara flipped the light switch, and we looked around Gramps' rumpus room. It was a classic man cave, and I suspect as a younger man, Gramps had used it for poker games and heavy drinking. The bar was polished oak. The wood floor was scuffed. The green felt on the poker table was faded and stained. Two overstuffed chairs sat in the middle of the room where, I imagined, high-top tables once held illegal drinks. Diesel looked around and smiled.
What? I asked him.
I like it. I might rent it out next time I'm in town.
You can invite Nurgle, I said. Have a mixer.
Diesel wrapped an arm around me.
I have a job for you.
Oh, boy.
I'd blindfold you, but I don't have a blindfold on me, so we'll save that for later, if you know what I mean.
Everyone knows what you mean.
The smile widened.
I want you to move around the room with your eyes closed. Just feel around and see if anything speaks to you. Usually you have to hold something in your hand to feel the vibration, but you felt the coin fragment behind the brick at the lighthouse, so let's see if you pick up any vibrations here.
Diesel guided me around the room. I felt the soft felt of the poker table. I felt the brick in the walls. And I felt a very faint hum as I ran my hand along the oak bar. Here, I said. I opened my eyes and traced along with my fingertip until I isolated the spot.
This wood has a lot of grain, and it has a dark stain on it, but it looks to me like it's been plugged where you're feeling the vibration, Diesel said.
He drilled into the bar with a corkscrew, popped the plug out, and then used the corkscrew to pry two pieces of coin out of the hole. He dropped the pieces into my hand, and I felt them hum.
They're empowered, I said.
Diesel took the five coin pieces out of his pocket and placed them on the bar top. I added the two new pieces, and they were a perfect fit. All the markings lined up.
If I had Wolf's piece of the coin, Charles III would have a whole head, Diesel said.
He pocketed the seven pieces of empowered coin. We retraced our steps back to the bakery, pushed the shelf across the tunnel entrance, and climbed the stairs.
Diesel used his thumb to swipe a flower smudge off my cheek.
I have some errands to run, and then I'll meet you at the house.
I might be home late, I said. I need to put together a menu for Ammon's party, and I should get a head start on the baking.
Chapter 12. Glow locked the shop door at 4 o'clock, hung the clothes sign in the window, and joined Clara and me in the back.
I've been doing research on demons, Glow said, watching me roll out pie crust for the tarts. I have a couple excellent anti-demon spells. We don't want to be caught short without protection.
I pretty much don't believe in demons, I said.
I believe in everything, Glow said. I'm a free-range believer. I even found some tests we can do on Ammon to prove his demonicness.
I can't see Ammon submitting to demon testing.
Exactly, so I found a spell that will make him cooperative. It's foolproof. I'm going to stop in at the Exotica shop after work and get the ingredients.
Glow looked at the pie crust.
How many tarts do you have to make?
400.
Yowza, that's a lot of tarts.
I'll make 4 different fillings, plus I'll have 4 large cookie trays, 4 large trays of miniature cupcakes, and a bananas foster station.
I can't wait, Glow said. I love parties. I promised Broomy could come. I hope that's okay.
Sure. He can help sweep up afterward.
Glow left, and Clara packed up and left a half hour later. I stayed until 5. I stored my tart shells, shoved my party menu into my tote bag, cut the lights, and locked up. I had my hand on the door handle of my car when I heard rustling behind me. I turned and saw Hatchet rushing at me. His eyes were crazy wide, his hair stuck out every which way, and his damp tights looked mostly dry, but droopy. He had his sword in his hand.
"Bitch wench," he yelled at me. "How dare thee dunk Hatchet? Thee art a cowardly sow to attack Hatchet from behind. Prepare to have Hatchet smite thee."
Crap. I wrenched the door open, jumped into the car, slammed the door shut, and punched the lock button. Hatchet brought the blade of the sword down hard on the roof of the car and recoiled from the impact. I cranked the engine and roared away with Hatchet running after me. I lost him after a block and a half. My heartbeat returned to normal after 3 blocks. Lucky for Hatchet, he didn't actually get to smite me, because Wolf wouldn't have been happy. And ugly things can happen when Wolf isn't happy. I walked into my house 20 minutes later. Diesel and Carl were already there. Cat was keeping his eye on them.
"What's new?" Diesel asked.
"Had an incident with Hatchet. He tried to smite me, but I was too fast for him. What's new with you?"
"I have to pull the plug on someone on the West Coast, but I want to do a show and tell for you first."
"Pull the plug? Is that like whacking someone?"
"No, whacking would imply death. This is more like cutting off someone's electricity because they didn't pay their bill."
I thought this was a conversation I didn't want to pursue. Sometimes you don't want to know too much.
We all went into the kitchen.
"Can you cook at all?" I asked Diesel.
"I can scramble an egg, make a sandwich, and open a beer bottle. I leave the fancy stuff to other people."
I was obviously one of those people who made the fancy stuff, so I pulled a couple chicken breasts and a bunch of root vegetables out of the fridge.
"How serious was the Hatchet incident?" Diesel asked.
"Hard to say. Serious enough to get my heart rate up. As it was, he put a big scratch in my car. Not that it matters."
"Do you know what caused him to attack you?"
"I sort of knocked him off the launch and into the bay earlier today, and I think it ruined his hairdo."
Diesel grinned.
"Nice."
I washed the vegetables and set them on the counter to chop. "So we're one coin fragment and a map away from finding the stone. All that stands between us is a demon and Wolf. Our troubles are over."
"The map will be easy, but I might have to trade you off to Wolf in exchange for his piece of the coin."
"What?"
Diesel was close behind me. He leaned in and kissed me just below my ear.
"I was kidding," Diesel said. "I wouldn't give you to Wolf. You're worth more than one piece. He'd have to throw in Hatchet to sweeten the deal."
I elbowed him in the chest. "Jerk."
"Yeah, but I'm hot," Diesel said.
"When will you be back from your plug pulling?"
"Hard to say. It shouldn't take long. I'll be back in time to steal the map on Saturday."
I took my chef's knife out of the drawer and diced the heck out of a carrot. You've got some serious aggression going there, Diesel said. If you need to relax, I can offer something better than carrot mutilation.
I looked at him with one raised eyebrow. Diesel was hands in his pockets, back on his heels.
Just saying.
Whack! I halved an onion.
Maybe later, Diesel said.
Chapter 13. At 4 o'clock sharp on Saturday, Glow hung the close sign on the bakery door, and we all assembled in the kitchen. We needed to load the van and arrive at Cupiditas for setup by 6 o'clock at the latest. The party was from 7 to 9. I'd been told it was a fundraiser for the preservation of the eastern spadefoot toad. I suspected most of the people attending didn't give a flying fig about the toad. They'd forked over $5,000 for a ticket to a Martin Ammon party and to get a look at his house. Josh and Glow were going to help me serve. They were dressed in standard caterer attire. Black slacks, white shirt, and red tie for Josh. Black skirt, white shirt, and red tie for Glow. I was wearing my one and only little black dress. So far, Diesel was a no-show. We had the van packed and ready to roll a little after 5 o'clock, and Diesel strolled in. He was wearing a black suit, black dress shirt, and black tie. Wolf dresses like that and looks like a Hollywood vampire. Diesel looked more like a bodyguard for Madonna. Who are you? I asked him.
I'm your van driver. Once a party gets underway, I'll be a guest who will wander unnoticed around Ammon's house and borrow his map.
Good luck with that one, I said. I couldn't imagine Diesel ever going unnoticed. He was big and scruffy in a rugged, movie star handsome kind of way, and he walked in a cloud of testosterone. You would have to be dead not to notice Diesel. 20 minutes later, Diesel drove the van through Ammon's gated entrance and parked in front of a garage bay. Rutherford and two household staff were waiting to help us unload. By 7 o'clock, we were set to serve. Guests were directed to the large, formal living room, and from there onto a terrace that looked out over the ocean. I had my desserts displayed on several tables on the terrace. My banana's foster station was indoors, in front of a bay window. Josh and Glow were circulating with sterling silver trays filled with cookies and homemade chocolates. Diesel was lurking in a corner. At 7:30, Ammon called everyone into the living room and drew their attention to me.
I would like to introduce Lizzie Tucker, Ammon said. Ammon Industries will be bringing out an entirely new line of products inspired by Lizzie Tucker and her magical kitchen skills. Every recipe in her brand new cookbook, Kitchen Magic, will eventually be available under the Ammon brand.
Everyone applauded, and I had to grip the serving trolley to steady myself. Wolf's warning that Ammon now owned me was echoing in my brain.
Miss Tucker will now be performing culinary magic, serving bananas Foster, Ammon said. Enjoy,